The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Chris McMillan is a senior lecturer in sociology and experiential education at Arcadia University, London. Chris moved to London from New Zealand in 2010, and he is the author of the book The London Dream, which is out next month from Zero Books. It's Thursday, July 30th, 2020, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. If you enjoy these podcasts, consider supporting us on Patreon. When you support us on Patreon, you get access to every podcast we put out, including two new podcasts on theory, cinema, and television. You also get access, starting next month, to a podcast series with Danny Scott on Trotsky and the Russian Revolution. The music you're listening right now is from the musical Sweeney Todd. It's called There's No Place Like London. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris McMillan and I discuss the coolness of the London Dream. Chris McMillan is a senior lecturer in sociology and experiential education at Arcadia University, London. Chris moved to London from New Zealand in 2010, and today he is the author of the book The London Dream, which is out next month from Zero. To start with, I'm just going to ask you the obvious question. Just what is the London Dream, and is it similar to the American Dream?
Some similarities in that it's a kind of mythos of a place that drives people there. Perhaps I could describe how I got there. I wanted to write a kind of Marxist, classical Marxist analysis of London, comparing 21st century London to Victorian London, basically suggesting that the accumulation of wealth is predicated upon the accumulation of misery. And I set up to interview a bunch of people, but the more people I interviewed, the more I found that they didn't really want to tell me about their miseries, even as we sort of shared stories. But they really wanted to tell me that they were on their way up. They loved London. That this was, they just needed to get this job, and then that'd be away. Things might be miserable now, but they were getting there. And that, to me, was kind of the story of hope, hope based in a place. So for me, the story of London is, or the London Dream rather, is a fantasy that London's a place of possibility, of prosperity, of excitement. And I think it's common to a lot of places. Perhaps not some smaller towns, but I certainly think you could say there's a New York dream. The American dream might be slightly different, but it's still a fantasy or narrative that animates a place.
Would you say that there's a class dimension to the London dream, that it's maybe a cosmopolitan dream or a dream of success beyond regular work, like a careerist dream, an international dream, even?
Yeah, you might say that when I say the London Dream, as if there's one specific dream. But what I try to chart in the book is that there are different versions of this that have been animated throughout London's history. And as I found when interviewing people, that different groups have different versions of their London Dream. In fact, this kind of dream, this narrative of London as the place to be, was strongest amongst those in the most precarious jobs. So I talked to a lot of cleaners who had come from Latin America through Southern Europe, so say Ecuador through Portugal through to London, and they were very keen on the idea that London, even though the conditions they worked in were brutal, that London was better than anywhere else. London was the place that they were going to make their money. But we can certainly see, and this is what I argue in the book, that there's kind of a dream of London as a cool place to be, which is very much an upper middle class dream. But the dreams of those serving the creative cool economy are no less.
Yeah. So what is a cool economy, and how would a cleaner in London from Latin America fit in or see him or herself fitting into the cool economy?
Ah, well, they're vital for the function of the cool economy is what I argue. So it comes down from two kind of angles. One is this idea of cool capitalism, or the conquest of cool, as Thomas Frank wrote, the idea that capitalism now is about consumption and consumption of experiences, and particularly subversive experiences. And the city is the way to experience that. If there's anything new, it's going to be happening in London, whether it's fashion events, music, pop-up, whatever's, you can do it in London. So the idea that cities are cool places to be, my argument is that I mentioned before that Marx in the 19th century had argued that the accumulation of wealth is predicated on the accumulation of misery. What I'm trying to suggest in the book is the accumulation of, or the production of cool of civilization is predicated on the accumulation of misery. So what I'm suggesting is that as cool as places in London are, you still require people to serve coffee, and behind them you require people to clean the dishes. And that cool economy relies upon a service class that's often not acknowledged.
I want to shift gears, and can maybe we can head into the 19th century for a bit.
Sure.
Reading your book, I thought about Sweeney Todd. What I think of Sweeney Todd as is a Sondheim musical, but he came from the 19th century as a character in the 19th century. He was a barber from Fleet Street who murdered his customers, and then with the restaurateur next door, their bodies would be turned into sandwiches or meat pies, actually. I'm sorry. So it's a sort of a legend of 19th century London. And there's the quote I want to read you from the musical. It goes like this.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, and its morals aren't worth what a pig could split, and it goes by the name of London. At the top of the hole sit the privileged few, making mock of the vermin in the lower soul, turning beauty into filth and greed. I, too, have sailed the world and seen its wonders, for the cruelty of men is as wondrous as Peru, but there's no place like London.
First of all, why was London considered such a pit in the 19th century? How did the vermin-filled cesspit version of London get transformed in that era?
There's a cherry story of Sweeney Todd. So in the 19th century, in Britain at least, we had great rural clearances in which and a mass urbanization of society, very common to around the developing world countries in the late 20th century. So essentially we had people from the provinces flowing in to London with the choice, if the word of the time, to take up jobs, not so much in factories. It wasn't, if in a British context, if you're looking at the big dark satanic mills, as they were called at the time, you'd be looking at the northern centers. London, fewer factories, but you're going in there for very much improvised work, and perhaps with the hope that you could make your fortune, that London wasn't just this horrible drudgery as pit, as Sweeney Todd sang, but that's a place for up-and-comers to sell things on the street or collect things, and you can make your way.
Yeah, and so was there more opportunity then, or was there a sense of opportunity that you could come in, you could sell your wares, you could do some work, you can maybe start up a barber shop, and you could make your way in the world and become a success in London, because there was a lot of opportunity for commerce and the market was good there, and the commercial market, consumer market was good, and that kind of thing. Or did people come in for factory work and manufacturing and think that they would be able to make enough with their wages to invest in that kind of entrepreneurial project?
With this kind of thing, it's not so much what was true at the time, or as much as what was the stories being told about it that motivated people. We have to start off with the acknowledgement that people didn't have a lot of choice but to come to cities for. But one of the things I explore in the book is around the Great Exhibition of 1851, where Prince Albert, the husband of Queen Victoria, essentially organized what we think of as a world expo of all the new commodities of the world to be sold and displayed. And this brought in tens of thousands of people to London and to see it as this shining light. And they were very concerned at the time that that the working classes would riot, that they would turn up at this idea. But when they had shilling day, a cheap day, they actually came in huge numbers and got what seems like, and of course there was lots of radical resistance at the time, but seems like caught up in the idea of the Victorian idea of progress, that things are going to get better, and that the labor-saving devices that they were seeing, their printing presses and toilets, were actually going to make their life better. And that was very much, you know, at the time, working people didn't have the right to vote,
right?
In Victorian London, but there is an ethos there that they've been brought along with progress. And say the Victorian Albert Museum was supposed to be an arena for refinement of the working classes, to bring them in and to be an antidote to the gin palaces. So there's kind of a dual narrative, one of a pit in which people are resisting, and one in which a city in which things are always getting better and you're always a step away from getting where you want to be.
The Great Exhibition. Daring in its concept and brilliant in all the details of its management, would prove to be one of the greatest phenomenons of the Victorian era. Brainchild of Prince Albert, the husband of England's Queen Victoria, it combined his interest in the progress of science with his amazing ability for organization. Ambitious beyond anything ever attempted, masterfully executed, moving rapidly from idea to reality, the exhibition could rightly be labeled the eighth wonder of the world. At the height of the Industrial Revolution, it brought the entire world together in the largest display of the progresses made in science, technology, and art throughout the world. As Prince Albert put it, it would afford a true test of the point of development at which the whole of mankind has arrived in this great task, and a new starting point from which all nations would be able to direct their further exertions. First, a location was needed big enough to host this grand event. The 350-acre Hyde Park was chosen as the setting, while plans were begun for a building that would house the thousands of exhibits brought to the location. Within 10 days, Joseph Paxton had designed a spectacular building of glass that would completely cover 19 acres of Hyde Park. Within 9 months, the Crystal Palace, as it was called, went from an idea scribbled on a piece of blotting paper to a structure of glass that enclosed 33 million cubic feet. 550 tons of wrought iron and 3,500 tons of cast iron supported 900,000 feet of glass. 202 miles of sash bars and 30 miles worth of gutters were used in its construction. In all, the finished building was 1,848 feet long by 456 feet wide and covered by a roof that soared 135 feet above the ground.
Was that exposition, you know, maybe the birth of a certain kind of cool London? Is the notion of progress and a better life through technological advancement connected to the, you know, late 20th century, early 21st century concept of a cool?
Yeah, I think we can draw something of a line there from the time that Romans set up in London and whitewashed things and created a sense of glamour and sold their slaves at the same time, or in Georgian London, where we had lights for the first time and the idea of shopping arose, and Samuel Johnson spoke of, if a man is tired of London, he's tired of life, and that kind of cliche going through to the creation of a London season in Victorian London that still kind of exists, of Henley rowing and Wimbledon tennis and Harrods shopping. So I think that it's had a number of different iterations, but the idea of London as a place in which what is happening in London has definitely been there for a long time, certainly since the Great Fire of 1666.
Right. And so what was it that gave the working class the impression that these new labor-saving devices and toilets and innovations was going to improve their life? And was there around that time an effort to expand the infrastructure of London, to modernize London in such a way that it really would maybe like bring more sanitary conditions to the working class districts or provide a different standard of living for the people of London?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to at all marginalize the role of resistance or radical consciousness at the time. But at the same time, you couldn't deny that on the surface, things in London could be seen to be getting better. We were having sewers installed that still exist. The London Underground, the tube was being invented. A lot of the big buildings around London, the Palace of Westminster was redone. The Tower Bridge was created at that time. And the suburbs, London suburbs, were being created and joined up with railways. And there was a sense that London was getting cleaner for some.
There's another side to that story. I mean, when we think about the London of Queen Victoria, these are the kinds of things we think about: the Industrial Revolution, the expansion of London's infrastructure, and as you mentioned, like the rail system. But what does that picture leave out?
The British have a particular way of dismissing history, or their own history, whether it's slavery or poverty or Victorian inequality, and just say that was something that was in the past. But yeah, the great story of Victorian London is that it overcame poverty rather than being stuck within it. And there's this narrative of progress.
Today you see people who are, you know, immigrating to London and doing janitorial work or doing the kinds of work that has to go on in the background, but that isn't not only isn't glamorous, but also may not be even livable ultimately, you know, not providing a subsistence wage without cruel or long hours, cruel conditions, disrupted life by a life disrupted by work. But you're saying that nonetheless, the ideology of London does a lot to mitigate against the kinds of acts of resistance or rebellion that might naturally come from that otherwise.
I think this kind of fantasy of our precarious lives exists outside of London and outside of Victorian London, that we're able to continue on with things that maybe we otherwise shouldn't, because we have a sense of a dream or a hope that things can only get better. And I think that allows people to endure precarious forms of work and continue to turn up in London or in New York or other areas, because they have a sense that things are on the improve, that this is the place of opportunity.
But on the other hand, you write about the gig economy maybe undermining
gig economies.
The London dream. Do you think that the gig economy and the way that so many different kinds of people, not just immigrants, are being kind of forced into a precarity and being forced to face their precarity is working against the ideology of the London dream?
Forced to face is perhaps a different issue. But I think something like the gig economy is actually vital for the London dream in two ways. One, that it's a sense that in big cities you can get Uber, or you can get, we call it Deliveroo here, the company, that you can get food delivered to you instantly, you can get Amazon packages instantly, that everything's at your doorstep. And that can only be at your doorstep on the basis of precarious labor, vulnerable to exploitation. So yes, that's vital to the gig economy, and the precariousness of the lives of people who live in it are vital for the cool economy and that version of the London dream that might be experienced by university graduates moving to the city. But also the people I talked to who were driving Ubers or research on the gig economy suggest that the people in the gig economy, people who were on the fringes of formal employment, were often the people who were they're very keen on this idea that London's the place to be, that they were able to make their fortune here, that other smaller places, they were on the margins of employment or really discriminated against, but the gig economy allowed them, even when they were acknowledging objectively they were being horribly exploited, that they were the ones making their fortune. They were driving and deciding when they were going to stop working with Uber or when they were going to do their own deliveries on their food motorbike, and that the only thing stopping them was kind of other people competing in the gig economy. So there's certainly this tension there, and this is what I try to draw the book, between different versions of a London dreamer, of kind of the exploited worker and the exploiting consumer. The question is whether those two are brought together or not to see the precarity.
When you were interviewing people in the gig economy, were they mostly younger people, or were these people who had been struggling for a while in these kinds of positions?
Mostly younger people. London, like a lot of big cities, has a very strong immigration rate after, say, 35 or roughly whatever age I am, that people have kids and start moving out of London. But yeah, there was tended to be younger, and they also tended to be migrants from poorer areas, in which living in London was, you know, it felt fancy in some sense.
So, like, when people would describe their trajectory from Uber driver into the future, did they have concrete goals within the, you know, terrain of what London was? Like, did they say, okay, I'm going to start here, I'm going to be an Uber driver, and then eventually I'll start my own restaurant and I'll compete with Uber? Or how would they envision their movement from drudgery into coolness?
Yeah, often so. And again, I don't want to be painting a story that, you know, Londoners are full of positivity and hope, because actually the ultimate ideology of the area is that everything's a bit shit and what are we doing here type of thing. That's the Londoner attitude.
Right, well, it's dialectical, right? On the one hand, I'm going to make it, and on the other hand, this place sucks.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing I catch when I, pre-pandemic, used to catch the tube into work, that you think, oh, this is just the worst. I'm just surrounded by people. But then I think about going home to New Zealand and I think, oh, what would I do without a tube that would just get me around? But anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, one of the arguments I was making is that often people who are working in the service classes, whether gig economy or cafes or bars or whatever, were the kind of employed reserve army of labor for the creative classes, for people working in the cool economy, that there's sort of a waiting zone for people, that they come to London. And, you know, not always, you know, lots of people come to London to just, or to work in construction or whatnot, but often the people were website designers who were driving cars. I remember a guy saying work was a little bit slow designing his website, but, you know, he knew I had a book coming out. Here's my card. I'll be back at work tonight, but I'm just doing a bit of driving during the day. So not always, but there was a sense that the gig economy allows people the freedom to choose their own mode of exploitation. Not that that's how people would put it, of course.
Well, back in the 70s, there was a television show on American, you know, network TV called Taxi.
How'd you come up with Taxi?
There was an article in New York Magazine, mm-hmm, about a cab company where everybody wanted to be something else. We went to do research in New York. We went to the company the article had been written about.
Okay.
We're in a cab company.
Yeah.
Where we stay in the cab company all night, and we're overnight from like midnight to whatever it was. And then we wanted to have breakfast with a group of cab drivers in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And that was going to be basically our research.
Right.
And now our problem was, how do you make a hero how do you make Judd Hirsch a hero? What delineates him? And the article was about everybody wanting to be, you know, something else, a boxer, an actor.
Yeah.
And now we're there. And all the cab drivers we're going to have breakfast with say, let's wait for whatever his name was to come in. And now this really solid, sort of clearly charismatic young guy comes in with his cab, and you can tell he's a hero to everybody there.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to be everything else. So we asked him the question about, what do you want to be? He says, me, I'm a cab driver.
Yeah.
And that was, and then we immediately knew that's what made him a hero.
I wonder if there might be secret taxi drivers in London, like people who are a little bit more world weary and who might be able to see beyond the ideology.
Yeah, well, not so secret. It's forgive me if I'm talking things you already know, audience. But in London, there's the famous black cabs. And it's a real story of class struggle here. So to be a black cab driver, you have to pass something called the knowledge, which you study for a couple of years. And you have to remember off the top of your head, they'll say, get from X Street to Y Street. And in an exam, and you have to tell them exactly how you can do it from memory. They tend to be almost overwhelmingly white and seen as very much the working class Londoners, and take a real pride that they are London's cabbies. But the black cabs are very expensive, and a lot of the work they can do wonderfully with their mind and memorizing London streets, my phone can do much more quickly. And so they're being taken on by Uber. Uber is currently banned and appealing that, but other private taxi other private taxi firms who perhaps don't identify so much as being drivers, but are overwhelmingly migrants making their way in London.
You know, when I was in London last, which was back in October, I took a black cab. I believe it was a black cab to try to get to the Airbnb where I was going to be staying. And I gave the cabbie the address, and he stood there on the curb and rubbed his chin for a moment and said, I think there's some areas that are blocked off, and I'm going to have to go in a roundabout way to get there, and you may have to walk a block. And I was like, what? And so I get in the car, and, you know, I'm tired because I've just gotten off an international flight, so I'm not particularly happy with this chin stroker. And I pull out my phone and put in the address and map it myself on the, and that I think was a faux pas. I mean, the cabbie stopped talking to me. It was an act of rebellion or sabotage or something.
It's a wonderful example of competing class struggles, really. The black cabs against the Uber drivers in London.
So okay, so this is the London dream. You yourself are caught in the London dream, which is a dream that's been evolving since the 19th century. How do we go about altering it, and how did people struggle against the ideology of London back in the 19th century? Like, for instance, the Chartists, did they have a role in creating the London Dream? Were they working against it? How should we position ourselves in relationship to the London Dream today?
You're pushing my knowledge of the Chartists a little bit. I think that the Chartist movement and the aims are fairly modest, really.
Well, they
today's
seem
terms.
Modest now, but I mean, at a time when the working class couldn't even vote, they were revolutionary demands, right?
Oh, absolutely. I suppose what I'm saying, and I may be mangling my point here, the Chartist demands were coming at a time of revolutions in right. Europe, and heads were being lopped off. And getting the right to vote perhaps seemed less radical at the time. Whether we'd say they're caught up in the London dream, I'm not sure. I think the fact that the working classes as a whole were subsumed within the Victorian ideals in general of progress perhaps speaks a little bit to the inability of the Chartists to make radical progress, though I wouldn't want to particularly go on the record about that, like doing a podcast interview or something. The question of how we can resist these kind of fantasies is a particularly difficult one. I mean, I'm someone who's writing about it and completely caught up in the idea that London is still the place for me to be. And that this is, I mentioned this a few times, that there's plenty of times in my London life where I think, what? Like, I know when I'm an American podcast here, but you'll have to forgive my British New Zealand phrase. I what the fuck am I doing here in London? It's cold. I'm poor. There's people around me all the time. Like, I've got families somewhere else. And then you just do something and you get a sense that, like, wow, this is incredible. And trying to match that in a way that disrupts your idea of London. And I, or disrupts your ideas of capitalism is perhaps the question that I'm struggling to get much coherence around here, really.
The story you're telling me about London, and by the way, as I said, I've been there recently. I visited Danny Scott, who helps me, who's definitely part of the cool economy, right? He helps me with the YouTube channel for Zero Books. And Zero Books is a UK imprint, but I'm an American. We have people all over the world who are participating and creating these books, and they're probably all participating in the they're all part of the precariat, right? They're all participating in the gig economy. Really, it's a gig economy venture. I mean, I've been the publishing manager for coming up on 5 years, and I don't have a set contract, and I just I put in my hours at the end of each month.
The issue here is that capitalism has, as I've written about previously, capitalism has included subversion within it, and therefore people who come to London who think of themselves as radical, who think of themselves as challenging the system, are actually simply perpetuating it, which is perhaps a simple point. Nonetheless, if you are a political radical, London remains the place to be. It just in the same way that if you are a fashion PR person, and often we end up on the same contracts.
It's kind of like Brooklyn in as well. Like, you know, Brooklyn is filled with leftists, filled with artists and writers and the literati, and most of them are on the left side of the spectrum. Many of them are even part of the far left. The people who write for Jacobin are often from Brooklyn, right? But they're all also struggling against each other to create brands, you know, in this new digital economy. They're all there's a lot of backbiting, if you want to see the Brooklyn cool kind of in operation, go on Twitter. And you can find out what that's like. Where is it in London where you have that that enclave of
that kind of energy? I think we'd say in the East End of London, areas around Shoreditch and Hackney and Dalston, areas that used to be old manufacturing areas and became fairly derelict in the deindustrialization of the 70s into 80s, and then became warehouses for raves and for artists, and have now become tech economy spaces and co-working zones. But this is all part of the tension of the city. The cities are wonderful places to be. I don't want to be knocking cities back. They have a great radical energy of a diverse range of people brought together and often sharing the same issues in solidarity. But there are also places in which capitalism runs, I was going to say ride, but it's a horrible cliche, but I'll keep that.
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you the story of Portland. I'm 49 mm-hmm. now, so I've been in Portland since 1991, which I guess is coming up on 30 years. Is that right? Oh, God. And when I moved here, the Northwest Portland was, fairly, it was gentrifying. But the northwest of Portland was also filled with, there was a brewery and there were these warehouse districts. Actually, when I moved here, there was an old mansion that had been converted into an apartment complex, an apartment house. And it was filled up with drug dealers, like meth dealers and things. But I also knew people who were working for the same kind of canvassing jobs that I was working. People, colleagues of mine, coworkers of mine, who lived in the lawn and this converted mansion. And I remember, it was an area that was in the process of gentrifying, and it was filled with young people and would-be artists, would-be revolutionaries even. And, we were slumming it, I guess, living in this dilapidated mansion, like something out of the movie Drugstore Cowboy. To 20 years later, not now, but 10 years ago, it was a completely refurbished condominium complex beautiful. And the whole area was filled with kind of mock brownstone walk-ups and condominiums. The brewery was gone and converted into a kind of upscale shopping mall. And, you know, it was an investment opportunity for – you could buy a condo for $500,000 or $1 million. And it's just gotten more and more intensely gentrified. And the young people today, they're not – going to Northwest Portland. They're not even going to Southwest Portland, which they were for a while. They're going to Northeast, which is used to be the kind of the black area of town. And there, that's what's gentrifying now. So this precariat lifestyle, this the dream of freedom and artistry and all of that, the bohemia that any city kind of tries to build up. It also is a force for capitalism and for gentrification and for development, and it moves around, I think. I guess the question was, is that the same story in London? It has that area, the revolutionary vanguard of the London dream. Is it moving around through London? Can you see it?
Yeah. Sure. Definitely been pushed out. There's actually, as I write about the book, there's a fellow called Richard Florida who has something called the creative class thesis. And he argues that basically cities should be developed as you described with Portland, that you make them cool, you attract talented people through tolerance and technology in the city, you get street artists to move in, he basically says if you have a good LGBT music scene, then your city's on the way because it'll start attracting tech people, will start attracting PR firms, and rather than investing in a new stadium or an Amazon warehouse, then people will start flowing in. And that's definitely the case in London, that in the East End in London in the 1990s, full of art, street art, drugs, prostitution, all kinds of things that are now being replaced by what they call Silicon Roundabout, which is a very grim version, very London version of Silicon Valley, that relies on this artistic tension that was there and it's now been pushed further and further out to the point where a lot of Londoners wouldn't recognize that as London. I think this is, as you're suggesting, this is very common in cities where you think, shit, is that area cool now? Do I have to go all the way out there? Am I that old?
Right.
And the answer is always, yes, I am that old. And no, I'm not going
out
there.
I'm definitely that old. There's no getting around it. Yeah, well, I wonder to what degree this symbiotic relationship between one thing I have to point out is that it's the notion of cool, the conquest of cool could happen because this notion of cool, in other words, this notion of progress and freedom and expression cannot be separated out from a politics of emancipation, that the things that drive people to invest in something like the London Dream also move them to the left generally, even amongst the working class. The most revolutionary or vanguard kind of people within the working class are young people who want to be free, who don't want to be constrained by life, who see their future as more open than people who are a little bit older or a lot older. So on the one hand, you can't give that up. And on the other hand, you can see how it's been used and it's moving around. But I wonder if the pandemic and the current economic crisis is going to disrupt all of that sort of symbiotic process.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wrote something on this for a blog called Left Foot Forward and trying to write something out. I'll get back to that. Anyway, I think there's two things going on with the pandemic. Right? People are definitely getting used to working from home and not – certainly in London and not going into the city center. And in terms of the service classes or the working classes that I write about in the book, there's a whole urban infrastructure that's built up around these office blocks. And while middle-class people can leave the city telecommute, others are left without buildings to clean or people to drive around. But there's also a sense that if people aren't going back into the cities, do they remain cool? Do they still if you graduate university, do you still want to come to London or New York or Portland? Or are you going to be stuck in the suburbs with your parents? Are we turning back to safety? I'm not too sure.
I don't know either. I know that, you know, in Portland for the last, 4 months, I guess, you know, no one's much left their home except for the Uber drivers and the food delivery people and the grocery workers and the essential workers of and the nurses, of course. My wife's a nurse, so she goes to work. You know, my lifestyle of sitting at the computer all day has become everyone's lifestyle in the last 4 months. But I do think it's a question is like how much of the service economy can survive going forward. Are we going to go see a return to the suburbs? It seems like, you know, if there's another pandemic after this one, I think it's kind of unavoidable that there will be a move out of from the center. Just the other day, I went to the drive-in with my family.
The drive-in, Doug. This is definitely going back in the past.
But it was a way to go see a movie.
Show starts in 1 minute. Please remember to replace the speaker on the post when you leave the theater. And now, on with the show.
It's an open question of whether people will no longer cluster together in that kind of way that drives creativity and drives radical movements, or whether will this eventually pass and we'll all just long for that sense of diversity and density that cities bring for us.
Right. I mean, it's a weird situation because on the one hand that density and that of the urban is what creates the ideology of cool, which we want to break from. But on the other hand, if it truly goes away, what will take its place is something like, I don't know. There was a early 20th century short story called The Machine Stops. I don't know if you ever heard of this story, but in it, it was Ian Forrester's story, and in it, everyone lives underground and communicates through telescreens or like and tubing. So like everything basically it imagines late 19th, early 20th century version of the internet that everyone communicates through, but they don't go see each other. They never leave their little cocoons. And they never go to the surface.
That's very familiar now.
And that's maybe our future, you know, where everyone has their little cocoon. We all communicate the way you and I are communicating now. I wonder, could there be such a thing as a sense of cool in such a world?
Yeah, I mean, without that sense of connection, do we have both diversity and solidarity? Do we end up with that kind of bumping space that cities bring? I'm not so sure. I mean, there's something about physical presence. I can't speak to it in much detail, but what's going on in Portland at the moment with resistance and protest relies upon physical bonds between people and people literally willing to hit streets.
It sure does. Yeah. And it also relies on the President of the United States doing everything possible to inflame the desire to hit those streets. It seems like he's gone out of his way to ensure that the federal buildings get set on fire every night. But
I have a number of British words there, but we'll skip over that, I think.
You know, and what's interesting about that is that the people who are downtown, some of them might be part from that, the Portland cool kind of scene, but a lot of them are from the suburbs now, or from, you know, the outskirts of Portland. At least they appear to be in the pictures, because you've got the Portland moms all lined up. It's a sort of a, on the one hand, it's very cool and empowering and kind of a smart move to see these women arm in arm across, you know, blocking the federal police from the younger protesters behind them. But on the other hand, it's like the absolute epitome of attachment parenting, right? You know, he's got these middle-aged mothers like, you're going to leave my kids alone as they're setting fire to buildings. Well, listen, is there anything I didn't ask you or something that we should, I mean, one thing you might do is maybe give an elevator pitch to listeners to see, to kind of let them know what they would be gaining from picking up The London Dream, which, you know, I would appreciate you doing because I want everyone to buy your book.
I guess we're breaking the podcast fourth wall here. So The London Dream is a story that animates London. It's set a million migrant journeys afloat. That it's a place of possibility, a place of prosperity, a place of excitement. And it brings so many to London, but it also ensures a steady supply of workers for London's businesses and for its cool economy, who always relies on people to serve it. And The London Dream speaks to those who come to London for the London season, to shop, to table club. And it also brings those who are simply seeking community and safety and an opportunity to better themselves, even if that means delivering food or driving Ubers and experiencing the worst in exploitation that London has to offer. For centuries, people have still come to London, no matter the exploitation and the hardships they face. With pandemics, with Brexit, with the 21st century in 2020, will they keep coming? That's what I'm writing about in The London Dream.